Christopher Cooper representing plaintiff appellants. If I may begin with a quote from Anderson v. Celebrezze, in which the Anderson court made it crystal clear that it rejected, quote, any use of a litmus paper test for separating invalid from valid restrictions, referring to valid and or invalid ballot restrictions. I want to turn the court's attention to Mandel v. Bradley, 432 U.S. 173, in which the United States Supreme Court sent a case back to the district court, a case much like this one, with instructions to the district court to take evidence. The 11th Circuit recently, in Green Party of Georgia versus the state of Georgia, an unpublished opinion, January 6, 2014, case number 13-118-16, said once again, as did the court in Mandel, district court, take this case back, apply Anderson, apply the three prongs of Anderson, sift through the evidence. Now, at the time of Mandel, it's a 1977 case, there wasn't Anderson to refer back to. In 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court referred the district court back to Stora and essentially said the district court should consider the extent to which the burden is increased in this case by the combination of a relatively early filing deadline and a relatively high signature requirement. In this case, the amplification issue is simple. We have a 12,500 signature requirement. We have a one signature rule and a 90-day collection period. Plaintiffs have filed an affidavit. And that affidavit shows that, one, there is a one signature rule and alleges that it's burdensome. Plaintiffs have filed pages and pages of statistics. Defendants haven't filed any evidence other than their own perceptions. Defendants say you would have a ballot the size of this telephone book that I'm holding in my hand if my clients were permitted, that is, if their names were permitted to be on the ballot. The defendants have not submitted any statistical evidence or any evidence that allowing...
You know, you should be talking to us. You don't have to talk to him.
Yes, sir. Allowing the names of many people to appear on a ballot would create this situation where you have a ballot the size of a phone book. Now, the district court takes a different position, where the defendants say the problem is we don't want a ballot the size of a telephone book. The district court says in page after page, and it cites Lubin, and it cites Rednor, and it says, guess what? There will be voter confusion. There will be chaos in the voting booths. If that's true, this case should be permitted to go to discovery. And defendants will then have an opportunity to show that what will come to fruition is what I'm holding in my hand, a ballot the size of a phone book.
Now, Mr. Cooper, what do you think would be a constitutionally acceptable number for signatures?
I don't have the answer to that, Your Honor.
Why not?
I don't have the answer to that, Your Honor, because this is a case that needs to go to discovery. This is a case that once all
How
the evidence...
5,000?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
5,000 be constitutional?
New York City's is 37,550.
My question was, do you think 5,000 would
yes,
be constitutional?
Yes, I do think 5,000 would be...
About 10,000?
No, I don't think 10,000 is workable.
What's the difference besides 5,000?
There's a huge difference, Your Honor. Some of the factors that I'm hoping the Seventh Circuit considers is that this isn't Texas, as in the earlier case cited by defendants. This is Chicago. If you knock on a door, maybe a person won't open the door, especially on the south side of Chicago where census takers can't even figure out who's in the house because people are afraid to open their doors. We need to come up with a number that makes sense, where you don't have to have what's often referred to as a machine-type army, referring, you know, to in democratic politics, you'll hear that terminology, where if you don't have hundreds and hundreds of circulators, if you only have, say, 10 or 20 circulators, there needs to be a way for those circulators to collect signatures. They're going to go to the Roosevelt Street subway station, by example. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is this. There are so many factors that need to be considered that haven't been considered. We're at the motion to dismiss stage. And comparing this case to a case in Texas where you have 55 days and you can collect 22,000 signatures isn't helpful. And for the defendants to certainly do nothing more than speculate that we'd end up with a phone book, that's not sufficient. Mandel versus Bradley makes it crystal clear. All right, you have to sift through.
That crystal clear is beginning to bother me. I don't know anything in law that's crystal clear, but you go right ahead. Otherwise, you'd be out of work.
I agree, Your Honor. Your Honor, I agree, but my point is, let's take, for instance, the predecessor to the case I just cited out of Georgia, the January 6th case, was the Berglund v. Harris case, 767 F. 2nd 1551. And in that case, the 11th Circuit cites Mandel, and right beneath citing Mandel, it says this, quote, similarly, upon remand of this case, referring to the case that was just remanded, the district court should sift, and I emphasize that word sift, and that's why I'm raising my voice, sift through the conflicting evidence and make findings of fact as to the difficulty of obtaining signatures, and it goes on. So my point is, this case has been dismissed not on summary judgment. This case has been dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage, where plaintiffs did not have to provide statistics. But as each one of you, I'm sure, know from looking at our briefs, we've submitted many statistics, as well as an affidavit, to say there's a real problem for many people who have social status but who may not have the financial solvency who seek to run for elected office. And some of those people who are unable to collect 12,500 signatures, believe it or not, espouse the views of many Chicagoans. Many, many Chicagoans. This time around, we had approximately 20 people who sought the office of mayor. Approximately 20. Five of those people dropped out of the race. That left 15 people. Of those 15 people, approximately 9 people satisfied the signature requirement. 6 of those people appeared on the ballot. No phone book. And I'm holding up the phone book again. 9 people. I also throw out, I posit, although I can't back it up with scientific evidence, that my sense is that in this technological age, the folks who tally votes know early on who will likely win, who will likely lose. We know early on if President Obama's in the lead. So the argument that all of these...
All you have to do is read the newspapers. They do polling.
But, Your Honor, I remember, I don't remember the exact case, but many years ago everyone thought a particular president won and he had...
It was Dewey versus Truman. Go ahead. Dewey defeats Truman.
Yes, Your Honor.
That wasn't the result of a poll. That was just a wishful thinking on the part of the Tribune. I mean,
but, Your Honor, in this...
Most of them take polls. Most candidates take polls.
Right. Your Honor, in this case, if you have, as did happen in Los Angeles in one case...
We had to eliminate elections. All we had to do was do a poll, and we could put... We don't have to vote for anybody.
Yes, Your Honor. But, Your Honor, as was the case in Los Angeles recently, we had over 100 people on the ballot for mayor. There wasn't voter confusion because, in the end, Your Honor, we knew that most of those 100 people weren't even close. My point is we've submitted preliminary evidence. We've done what we've needed to do as plaintiffs at the beginning stage of a lawsuit. And it's not enough. It is not sufficient, in my mind, that this case is dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage because the defendants speculate we're going to end up with a ballot the size of a phone book, or because the district court speculates that, hey, there is going to be chaos. And one last point. The Monroe case M-U-N-R-U, the Monroe case, does not, in my opinion, knock out Anderson's requirements. The Monroe case is a 1977 case that simply says you can speculate, but it doesn't, I think that's, the Monroe case was speaking to a state legislative body and saying to a state legislative body, you're welcome to speculate. I think that if Monroe was met, as Judge Dow has described it, a case where the board is allowed to speculate, I don't think we would have ever had Anderson.
You know, you're under your rebuttal time. I just thought
I'd I'm out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Scanlon?
May it please the court. I would like to first address the three cases, only three cases that Mr. Cooper cited in his opening remarks. I believe one was Mandel versus Bradley. There was another case, a Green case. And the third case he cited, I think it was a Berger case. I may be wrong. I think it was Berger or Bergen. But I can't really address myself to those cases because they were not cited in Mr. Cooper's brief. So I'm not at liberty and not in a position to address what those cases said or did not say. Mr. Cooper also said that he has an affidavit saying that there is no one signature rule. Now, I think we went back and forth with this issue in the district court. And I think Judge Dow came to the clear understanding that, in fact, there is a one-signature rule, that it is clearly set forth in the statute in Section 10-3 of the Illinois Election Code. So I thought that perhaps Judge Dow put that issue to rest, but perhaps not, because Mr. Cooper is still claiming that there is no one-signature rule, and I'm guessing that he's going to claim or argue that this was simply a notion or policy of the board. As he did below. That claim is absolutely incorrect. It is a part of Illinois law. Also, Judge Hamilton asked Mr. Cooper the question, well, what do you think is a constitutional number? And Mr. Cooper agreed that perhaps 5,000 is a constitutional number. He would not accept the 10,000 number as a constitutional number. But even assuming that 5,000 were the benchmark, were the minimum signature requirement, in this case, Judge Dow found that there are at least two of these plaintiffs, Mr. Stone and Mr. Ray, filed less than 5,000 signatures. In fact, Mr. Ray filed 2,625. Mr. Stone filed 250 signatures. So even if the signature requirement were to be set at 5,000, we would probably still be here arguing this case on behalf of Mr. Ray and Mr. Stone. The fact is, there is no magical algorithm that will calculate the perfect signature requirement. Basically, it is an arbitrary number. Whatever that number is, it's a number. But it's the prerogative of the legislature to establish that number.
Are there cases that have struck down requirements higher than 1% of the electorate?
I'm sorry, 1% of?
I'm sorry. Are there cases striking down numbers as high as 1% of the electorate?
I don't believe so. Not in the sole context of signature requirement. We have, I think the courts have said that Jeunesse v. Fortson kind of set the outer limit. In Jeunesse v. Fortson, the signature requirement was 5% of the total number of registered voters. That's registered voters.
And here that it's about 1%, right?
Actually, in this case, it is less than 1%. Judge Dow found that the 12,500 signature requirement, when divided by the total number of registered voters, and that number of registered voters was a number that plaintiffs put out there. Taking that number, it was 0.92%, or less than 1% of the total number of registered voters. Of the percentage of people who voted in the previous election, the signature requirement comes out to a 2.73% of the number who voted in the previous election, and that would have been in 2007. Now, as I said, Janice V. Fortson accepted a signature requirement of 5% of the total number of registered voters. There are many more cases, and we've cited in our brief, that have said that 5% of the total number of people who have cast ballots is an acceptable number. And in fact, we have a number of those cases that were decided based upon Illinois law. And we had two cases, the Illinois State Board of Election versus Illinois Socialist Party workers case, and the Black case that said 25,000. I'm sorry, Norman versus Reed, said 25,000 was an acceptable minimum signature requirement in the city of Chicago. So there's a legion of cases out there that have accepted as constitutional signature requirements that are well above what we have here in Illinois for the city offices in the city of Chicago. If we were to accept an argument that these signature requirements should be lowered in order to accommodate what Mr. Cooper refers to as ordinary citizen candidates, then if we're going to accept all of these candidates as legitimate candidates who have an entitlement to be printed on the ballot, you have to go down to Mr. Stone, who filed 250 signatures. There's only one other candidate who filed fewer signatures than Mr. Stone, one out of 20. If you accept the fact that 250 is a permissible, up the upper limit, a permissible level, and you do the math, that comes out to 0.55% of the voters who voted in the 2000 election. And I'll ask my math be checked, but that's the number I calculated.
I think you're a little high.
250 out of the total number of registered voters would come out to be 0.18%. These numbers are well below the Janice V. Fortson 5% of registered voters. These are well within the range of acceptability and reasonableness. Now, we learned from Lubin versus Panish. The court said that a procedure which invites or permits every citizen to present himself to the voters on the ballot without some means of measuring the seriousness and the seriousness of the motivation of those candidates would make rational voters' decisions more difficult because of the size of the ballot, and which would lead to widespread confusion. This court in Navarro versus Neal, which is a case recently decided by this court, said light regulation of ballot access could lead to unmanageable number of frivolous candidates. Relaxing or abolishing these signature requirements would attract a significant number of frivolous candidates, leading to phone book size ballots and the widespread voter confusion. Phone book size ballots was the language of this court. Now, again, if you accept the premise that the limit should be set at 250, then 19 of the 20 candidates who filed for mayor in the city of Chicago in 2011, 19 of those candidates would have been on the ballot. And that, consider that 20 candidates filed, knowing that the signature requirement was $12,500. Can you imagine how many more people might have filed petitions for mayor or other city officers?
That many people want the job, but go ahead.
Well, there may be a number who do think it's an attractive position, but if they do that the signature requirement was as low as 250, imagine the number of petitions, the number of candidates we would have on the ballot in the city of Chicago. I don't think that was a result that was contemplated by our courts. I think that even Mr. Cooper conceded in his brief the state has an interest in limiting voter confusion by limiting ballot access to candidates who can demonstrate at least some level of political viability. They concede that. But then they claim that these particular candidates did, in fact, show the necessary modicum of support. We suggest to you that that's not the case. That's not the case. I did want to address for a moment the other two elements, because Mr. Cooper has claimed that not only the signature requirement, but also Illinois' requirements that signatures be collected within a 90-day period, and a requirement, or actually a prohibition, against signing more than one independent petition. Those three requirements, acting in concert, were onerous or insurmountable. Judge Dow below found, based on the record, on the facts that were presented to him, that, and especially the fact that there are 15 candidates who filed above the minimum, nine of whom ultimately survived ballot challenges and were entitled to be on the ballot. Based on that record, based on that experience, those ballot access requirements are not insurmountable. The 90-day limitation or collection period, the plaintiffs have not submitted any case on that. And there's very little argument in their brief about it. But we've had a number of cases that have been decided since that restriction was put into the law in 1984. In fact, four of the six cases which have addressed signature requirements well in excess of the 12,500, specifically the Rednauer case, Norman, Black, and Lee, the 90-day collection rule was in place in all those cases, and the courts did not find any constitutional violation. An American Party of Texas, in that case, there was 55 days to collect 22,000 signatures. In Nader versus Keith, this court said that Illinois' scheme is much like the scheme in the state of Texas, except that we gave candidates an additional 1 month to circulate petitions. So I don't think there can be much argument that the 90-day collection rule is somehow unconstitutional because it establishes an insurmountable barrier. With regard to the one signature rule, in 1971, a three-judge panel of the United States District Court for the Northern District in Jackson v. Ogilvie rejected a claim that limiting voters to one nominating act was unconstitutional. In that case, the statute said that someone who signed a petition for an independent candidate could not vote in the primary for that same election. The court said that under Baker v. Carr, one man, one vote principle, you are limited to one nominating act. And if that have a choice between signing the petition or voting in the primary, you have that choice, but you cannot have it both ways. So they rejected the claim that kind of a prohibition was unconstitutional. In American Party of Texas case, the United States Supreme Court quoted Jackson v. Ogilvie, and in that case upheld limitations that limited voters from signing one petition for one independent candidate, or voting in a primary, or voting for signing an independent petition. So the restriction on signing petitions has been upheld in several cases. In Store v. Brown, the court said, we have no doubt about the validity of disqualifying from signing an independent petition all those who voted in the primary. A state may confine each voter to one vote in the same nomination process. So I believe, I submit, that the one signature rule is not violation of the Constitution. In Lee versus Keith, this court did have an opportunity to consider the one signature rule in conjunction with several other requirements. That court dealt with a challenge to an independent candidate for state senator. In 1975, the Illinois legislature moved the deadline for filing petitions up to 323 days before the general election. That was the earliest filing deadline in the nation. In 1979, the General Assembly doubled the minimum signature requirement for independent candidates for legislative office from 5% to 10%. The court in Lee said that those restrictions had the effect of essentially prohibiting independent candidates for legislative office. If I just finish the thought, Your Honor. The court did a little bit of an arithmetic, and they found that when you consider the one signature rule, the minimum signature requirement was then above what the court had approved in Jenness v. Fortson. I suggest to you in this case, just doing a little bit of arithmetic. If you take out the number of people who signed petitions in 2011, take those out of the equation, and that is a number that plaintiffs supplied in their brief at page 14. You take that number out, and you still have an available pool of signatories of 793,385. If you divide the signature requirement by that number, it comes out to 1.57%. Again, well below Jenness v. Fortson. I want to thank the court and ask respectfully the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Scanlon. Ms. Cooper?
I'll be quick. Defendant's counsel did not hear me. We submitted an affidavit asserting there was a one-signature rule. When defendant said there was not a one-signature rule, we concede that there is a one-signature rule. For another day is the issue of its applicability to City of Chicago elections. Defense counsel uses the term independent candidates. There is a distinguishing character between an independent candidate and a nonpartisan candidate. The City of Chicago elections are nonpartisan in nature. The one-signature rule by itself is not unconstitutional. But let's use Stora. Let's use Anderson. Let's use the third prong of Stora, of Anderson, and we end up with the one-signature rule amplifying the ballot restriction of 12,500 signatures. Second, the issue of percentage, the science you were just presented with is dead wrong. Page 12 of Judge Dowell's opinion. He's got it right. It's based on the number of people who voted in the last election. It's 2.7%. 2.7. The science you were just given by defendant, I'm sure it was unintentional, was wrong. Judge Dowell agrees. The issue, or the amount, 2.7. Judge, you asked, is there a case? Yes, there is a case, okay, that where we're at 1% or below. That's the case I referred to, January 6, 2014, Green Party of Georgia versus the state of Georgia, 13-118-16. There is a case where, now granted, that case had to do with the presidential election, but there is such a case. The issue of, reference to independent candidates, I made some notes here and I realize I've already addressed that one. The reference to the American Party of Texas, that's a 1974 case. It is in Texas. It's not Chicago where people don't open their doors. It's not Chicago where our brief shows it could cost a candidate approximately $2 a signature. In some cases, maybe $5 a signature. That's how much you have to pay the circulator for each signature. At one point, defendant's counsel made a reference to 19 could have been on the ballot. I think he meant 9. He had to mean 9 because only nine submitted 12,500 valid signatures. My last point is this. This case is not before you gentlemen on summary judgment. This case is here pursuant to a motion to dismiss. The Supreme Court of the United States has made it clear. I'm not going to use the term crystal clear. All right, has made it clear in Mandel Bradley. And again, all right.
How do you think Mandel holds up under Iqbal?
It holds up because under Iqbal, I don't have to throw in the kitchen sink, Your Honor. Under Iqbal, I have to give you enough. Just enough. I have to give you enough to show that there's a plausible issue. All right. Both Iqbal and Twombly say that we should still be here. Somehow this case was this case was litigated without the plaintiffs present. We need an opportunity to sift through the evidence. Then the defendants will be allowed to put on their evidence that will end up with a phone book. We can put on our evidence that this isn't 1974. That's American Party of Texas. It's a 1974 case addressing the collection of signatures in Texas in a very different geographic environment at a very, very different time. I believe we've satisfied Iqbal. I believe we've satisfied Twombly. And I can't say much more than that. This is not a summary judgment case.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Thank you, Mr. Scanlon. The case is taken under advisement.